The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Talking about is the qualities whereby Hashem becomes manifest in our lives. And these qualities are what's referred to as the Sefirot. And they're also interconnected, that as I speak about each Sefira, in a certain way it includes certain knowledge that we already know about other Sefirot. It's like Jewish philosophy cannot be presented, and certainly not Kabbalah cannot be presented as simply 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's somewhat like a picture being developed. So if you've ever seen a picture in developer, so it doesn't just gradually in a linear way come clear and voila, it's there right before your eyes, right? A little gray is happening up here and a little black's happening over there and a certain figure is coming over there. And so it takes a while because it's all really happening because it's so integrated and so interconnected that really certain things you say is already with the consideration of understanding or other certain things which haven't really been spoken of. Okay. So what we've dealt with until now is we've discussed the meaning of malchut, the meaning of understanding, seeing life and the world through the lens of kingdom. Seeing everything as a kingdom, as part of a kingdom, we're all part of a joint enterprise. We're all members. There are orders, there's a symmetry, and the kingdom is the vessel to receive the blessings of Hashem. That's how it's described. What does the kingdom receive the blessing from? What is the blessing kingdom's going to receive? Life. Yisod. When we look at the world through the lens of Yisod, the lens of that quality called Yisod, then what do we essentially see? Life, goodness, allness, fullness, abundance. Okay? But the truth is that Yisod is really a combination of all the other flavors, right? All the other spiritual flavors. All the other spiritual qualities. It's the quality that brings it all together and channels it to the receptacle, which is the kingdom, and ourselves as part of the kingdom. And so now the difficulty is how do we taste within life and goodness all the different ingredients that make it that? And that shouldn't be confused to think that Yisod is the sum, right, of the parts, of all the other qualities. Because it's a whole greater than the sum of the parts. That's why it's also referred to as kol. Okay? It's like a motorcycle is not springs and wheels and handlebars. A motorcycle is already a reality which goes much more beyond simply the assembly of it. Okay? It's a certain reality. It's a whole which includes all these parts. So therefore, the taste of Yisod, so to speak, when you look at the world with the eyes, with the lens of Yisod, and you see the allness, and you see the aliveness, and you see the goodness, and you see and taste and experience the blessing. Now I want to try and understand the ingredients that goes into that blessing. Alright? The ingredients of that blessing. And that's difficult. That's like tasting a delicious dish and being able to say it has a half a teaspoon of salt, it has a half a cup of sugar, it has some lemon rind, three lemons. Do you understand? Somebody told me they know somebody who has the ability to taste anything and break it down into its ingredients. But the interesting thing is, that doesn't mean that they tasted a little bit of salt and they tasted a little bit of sugar and some lemon. They tasted this dish, right? Which is the Yisod, which is life, which is blessing. But now all the other qualities that pour into that, it makes that dish and then Malchus consumes it, receives it. That's the qualities that we're working on, right? The ingredients, the flavors that go into this delicious, right? This delicious blessing called life. Alright? So it becomes a little more difficult. Because some of what we want to become sensitive to is almost like talking about a color you've never seen. And so trying to get the sensation of what these tastes are, what these spiritual ingredients are that go into really life, being alive. What these spiritual qualities are through which the Ein Sof, the endless light, the endless one becomes manifest, that becomes a little more difficult. Okay? So what I'm going to give out today is an article, Radical Amazement. And why I'm sharing this with you is because it's with the eye for radical amazement that a person is able to really begin to taste that life, right? Taste that life. So let's begin. Reason and wonder. What he's going to do is he's going to distinguish the difference between reason and wonder. The greatest hindrance to knowledge is our adjustment to conventional notions, to mental cliches. What does that mean? If you really want to know something, the thing that gets the most in the way is thinking that you already know it. In other words, the first step to knowledge is to know that you don't know. And that sounds easier, that's certainly easier said than done. Because generally we don't realize how much we actually think we already know. How much we actually assume that we know. And that the way I see it is the way it really is, because that's the way it's seen. Do you follow this? It's a story I told you, I think I told you, when I went to a fellow who does handwriting analysis. And part of the handwriting analysis is he asks you to draw a tree on the back of the page. So I was drawing a tree on the back of the page. The guy beside me was drawing a tree on the back of the page. And there was another guy drawing a tree on the back of his page. But the guy beside me, he drew this huge tree in the middle of the page, taking up the entire page. And the guy beside him was drawing this itsy bitsy teeny weeny tree in the corner of the page. Right? Well, what was really funny is the fellow who drew the big tree, I know you'll probably understand what big tree means. He looks over at the guy who's drawing the little tree. And I see he's kind of looking. He's a little uncomfortable. And finally he says to him, I'm sorry, but I noticed a tree. He says, yeah. He says, well, that's not what he wants. What do you mean it's not what he wants? I mean, I'm sorry, but I just want to help you out. You know, maybe it's none of my business, but it says in the instructions to draw a tree on the back of the page. I mean, he doesn't want a little teeny tree in a corner of the page. He said to put it on the back. I mean, he wants you to put up, you know, a tree on the whole back of the page. You know, like mine, you see? Like that. So now you'll understand what a little teeny tree in the left corner is. He goes, oh yeah? Oh, that's what he wants. Thanks a lot. Starts rubbing out his tree and basically starts copying the tree of the guy next to him. Now you see, this guy, with all good intentions, doesn't realize how much he assumes. He thinks he knows. He thinks that when he reads and it says on the back of the page that means what he interprets it to mean, and there's no other way it could be understood, because that's exactly what it is. In other words, he doesn't understand the sentence, he sees his interpretation of the sentence. And he doesn't realize that they might not be synonymous, right? And so he already has a cliche understanding of tree, a cliche understanding of draw on the back of the page, and to him, that's exactly what it means. I know what that means. I know exactly what that means. And I go ahead and do it. And it's so surprising to him that someone else couldn't understand it that way. All right? That is the first step in communication. That is probably one of the difficulties in being married. Because you begin to be challenged. Things that were just so obvious to you. Things were just clearly reality. That's the way it's done. That's the way everybody does it. That's the way everybody thinks or whatever think any way else. All of a sudden you find out that your wife or husband has a complete take on the situation. And you begin to realize that the greatest hindrance to knowledge is our adjustment to conventional notions. We have conventional notions that we are totally adjusted to, and we have mental cliches that we are absolutely not aware of, that we already are living in certain mental cliches. It's like, you know, all the wonderful labels like conservative, reform, orthodox. It's really problematic. Because if a person says, well, what are you? And I then say, well, I'm orthodox, then immediately they know who I am. They know exactly what I'm all about. Right? And they're clear what that word means, and there's no question what that word means, and there's no question what that means about me. But I remember I had a very interesting discussion with a fellow in Miami, and he's a very philanthropic fellow. And we were having a discussion about Israelite, what I envision it doing for the Jewish people. And he said, you know, I would like to introduce you to a certain foundation that I know. So I said, well, I'm familiar with that foundation. And unfortunately, I think it'll become problematic when they find out that I'm Orthodox. He said to me in shock, he said, you're not Orthodox. Right? He said, you're not Orthodox. I said, what do you mean? I mean, if I have to technically define myself, which I prefer not to because I don't like these labels, and I don't think this label's big enough for what I really feel I would like to express myself as, but I mean, if I get down to if I'm put in a corner, this is what I'm going to have to say. He said, Rabbi, we have been talking for 2 hours already, and I'm telling you, you're not Orthodox, right? So do you realize how he is stuck in his way of understanding? See, had I walked in there and said I'm Orthodox, he would have, you know, and all those barriers would go up, and, you know, oh, he's Orthodox. And he would see me through the eyes of his mental cliche of what that word means, and he would never see me, right? He would never hear me, and we wouldn't be communicating. Okay? Because he's stuck in mental cliches. Well, this is the biggest hindrance to getting anywhere, which is that people are locked into mental cliches and they don't realize that. Wonder or radical amazement, the state of maladjustment to words and notions, is therefore a prerequisite for an authentic awareness of that which is. That's who we're looking for. That which is. The yud, the hey, the vav, the hey, the was, the is, the will be, the ultimate, timeless is. And so, if I want authentic awareness of Hashem, then I have to start with wonder and radical amazement. And how does that happen? When I have a maladjustment to words and notions. Like, you know, like all of a sudden, what I'm seeing doesn't fit into my neat packaging. To my neat packaging. And so, that's the first step. To realize that in order to know, I have to adopt a new way of knowing. If I'm interested in taking a life journey, if I'm interested in enhancing my life experience, well, then I have to have the openness, the flexibility to see new, see newness, and not assume that everything you're saying is what I already know. That's the problem with pat answers. Before you even get a chance to finish your question, the educator already knows what the question is, you know, and has already got an answer for it. But maybe that's not their question. So you got to learn to always listen for the first time. And every time, listen for the first time. See for the first time. And every time, see for the first time. It's very difficult. Very, very difficult. It's very difficult for people to come in to Israelite or any kind of environment where they're learning because they have so many preconceived notions already that if I say Torah, I say mitzvah, I say God, I say rabbi, whatever I say is going to be screened through. And already I know what you're saying. I've already figured it out. And people jump to conclusions. You're this, you're that, you mean this, you mean that. I didn't say that. That's what you heard. So this is really an exercise in seeing and hearing, tasting, in a way of total freshness, which is very, very hard. That's probably one of the reasons why non-Jewish people are more receptive, because they don't have preconceived notions. So if I give a class, I tell you very often when I do public lectures and there's a large crowd there, I can often tell who's not Jewish in the crowd. It's the ones that most interested. Unbelievable how interested they are. Because they don't have any preconceived notions, so they actually hear me. Right? Because they've never heard anything like this. Right? And they come up to me and start asking me questions. I once did a youth group. And I was told that everybody in the group is Jewish. Not that that so much mattered to me, but that's what I was told. And so after the class, this one woman comes up to me, and she doesn't look Jewish. Now, I know that's kind of strange. What's a Jewish look? You know, that sounds a little difficult, but I just didn't think she was Jewish. But I was told that everyone was Jewish. Again, it wasn't a big deal for me, but I thought this is strange. So she comes up to me and she's asking me this question and that. She was so excited about everything I had to say. I just found it so difficult to believe that she could be Jewish. Right? So I did some research and it turned out that she actually wasn't Jewish. And the reason why she was on this youth tour with all these Jews is that her mother was going to marry a Jew. Right? And so to kind of get used to the fact that this new stepfather is going to want some Jewish awareness in the home, she needed to be somewhat aware of that, so they sent her to Israel on a Jewish youth group. Right? The interesting thing is that this woman later converted, right? Totally converted to Judaism. But my point is that we are not aware enough of how biased we really are and how closed we really are and how we're basically accusing everybody of being dogmatic when in fact we ourselves could be already dogmatic about being dogmatic. So the first step in true knowledge is a maladjustment to words and notions, mental cliches, and I'm ready for an authentic awareness of that which is. That's all. Standing eye to eye with being as being, we realize that we are able to look at the world with two faculties, with reason and with wonder, eye to eye, face to face. Face up to the truth. What does it mean to face up to the truth? Face to face. Not looking at it from the side, but face to face. And that's done through two ways. There's two ways you can look at the world. Two lenses you could put on. One is the lens of reason. One is the lens of wonder. Learning to see the world with the eyes of wonder. The eyes of wonder. That's interesting. There's a verse in Proverbs that says, Reshit Chachma Yirat Hashem. The beginning of wisdom is awe for God. One must see the world through the eyes of awe. What's awe-inspiring? The word awe gives you a sense of it. It's when that fireworks go up and you go, awe. What was that? I beg your pardon? I mean, imagine the next day you see on the front page of the newspaper, you know, an article that discusses the fireworks last night, and all it said was, oh, ooh, well, what is that? What is that? It's something just so dazzling, and even dazzling is a word. I don't have words. I simply have no words. I meet reality without words. I find this to be a difficulty that I have with my baby. Right? I simply have no words to describe my feelings every time I see him. So I find myself making up words every time I see him. I look at him, I say, you're a poochie moochie goochie. Now, I don't know, you know, maybe I'll create a vocabulary, have a dictionary, and maybe my children will pass on, and someday I'll have this whole new vocabulary. But I see my kid, and I just have no words, so I just make up words. And I'm making up words all the time when I see him. Because I have a total maladjustment whenever I see this baby. Where did this baby come from? I mean, you're supposed to tell me from a microscopic sperm cell? I mean, really? That's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And so, there's reason and there's wonder. The first we try to explain or to adapt the world to our concepts. That's what reason is about. Reason is trying to explain that which is. And we explain it with old ideas. Right? That which we have in our storehouse of words and concepts. Right? But what if I really don't have in my dictionary a word for what is it I'm seeing? Well, reason doesn't allow for that. Reason says, explain and adapt the world to your concepts. See, that's one of the major problems that people have when they come and they say, I would like to know how Judaism fits into my life. Well, then you haven't come for wisdom. Because you've already come with an assumption that your life, right, and the way you see things, and the way you understand things, is absolutely adequate to understand the message of Torah. And if Torah cannot adapt itself to your life, if it cannot be explained with your vocabulary, or your expectations, or what makes you feel good, well, then you say this Torah is illogical. This Torah is unacceptable. This Torah couldn't be real. That is really a problem. Right? This is really a problem. This is the issue of, I want to know if it's relevant. Well, what does that mean, relevant? Relevant generally means that it's relevant to me. But who says you're relevant? Right? Who says you're relevant? It's Torah that says you're relevant. If there isn't a Torah, if there isn't a God, if there's no purpose, if there is no theme to life, then you and I are not relevant anyways. So it's a strange thing to say, I expect it to be relevant to me, when in fact it's saying, you have to see if you're relevant to it. That's a whole new way of seeing things. But that's very difficult. You know what? It's humbleness. And humbleness is not the easiest attribute for everybody to achieve, including myself. To be able to say, I don't know. And I come with no knowledge. I rid myself of all preconceived notions. I will be very cautious and careful to check any mental cliches that I have somehow unconsciously adopted. I have no expectations. I have no criteria that says, it's got to do this. I just want to see it as it is. That's very hard, but that's the beginning, to taste life, to be receptive to life. Because as time goes on, we miss out so much. You know, imagine a person's whole life is money. Stocks, bonds, and their whole vocabulary is that. Now imagine you're sitting with this person and it's a really special romantic moment. And the moon is shining so beautiful. Everything has this very special aura. And there's this sweet breeze. And this person turns to you and says, I feel terrific. I am feeling so terrific. I mean, the moon, it's shining like a new silver dollar. I beg your pardon? And the freshness of the air. Ah, new bills off the press. Ah, and your eyes, like shining pennies. You really have a way with your words. You're really romantic. I mean, but that's all he has. That's all he can see the world through. That's the only thing he'll get. So, we're not aware of it. We might have a very, very select mental cliches that we've imprisoned ourselves. Literally imprisoned ourselves. And we're not seeing what is. So, reason tries to explain, to adapt the world to our concepts. Everything has to make sense to me, in my way of thinking, and my level of experience. Through the second, through wonder, we seek to adapt our minds to the world. I give my mind over to the world. I give my mind over to what is. I don't expect is to fit my mind. I want my mind to fit what is. Children have that way in the way they look at the world. If you look at the eyes of a child as he looks at something, he consumes it. It looks like he's drinking it with his eyes. There's something in the eyes of children that I am envious of. Because they look at this world and they don't know what it is, and that's why they know so much more than me. They see so much more than me. But I look at the world and I think I know what it is. So learning to not be so sure that you know what it is. You know, if a person says to you, you know, I really know who you are. They don't know anything. How could you know who I am? I'm a soul. I'm a spark of infinity. Right? You're this. You're that. You know, I realize there's basically three categories. I mean, come on. See me. See me. Relate to me. Don't try and stuff me into your labels, your categories, your mental cliches. And that's the way we need to begin to really learn, to really be educated. We have to put on the lens of wonder. Wonder rather than doubt is the root of knowledge. When you come in and you say, I just wonder what this is. Great. Ah, a wondering Jew. Terrific. You know, terrific. Doubt comes in the wake of knowledge as a state of vacillation between two contrary or contradictory views. As a state in which a belief we have embraced begins to totter. You see, wonder is the root of knowledge. But doubt comes after knowledge. Why do you doubt? Because you already have a certain knowledge. And now something seems to be communicating a different knowledge, which is conflicting with this knowledge. And now you're starting to doubt. But doubt starts with knowledge and a conflict between different knowledges. Different attitudes, different mental cliches, whatever it is. And now I'm trying to figure out, well, should I go with this knowledge or should I go with that knowledge? But you see, I think it was Mark Twain that once said, sometimes a wrong choice is not a lack of knowledge, but a lack of imagination. Because you didn't realize that there was actually a third choice. And that's why it was the wrong choice. Because the choice is that I choose to believe that there's only two options here. So I made the wrong choice because I didn't have enough imagination to realize that there was actually a third choice. That I didn't even include as a possibility. I remember this very strong. I was making a decision. I had a job in Toronto. And I was very unhappy with it. I was very unhappy being in Toronto. And well, there were pros, there were cons. And I made a great list of pros and I made a great list of cons. And I was really in a tremendous state of doubt. And I was sharing this with a friend trying to get some advice. And this friend turned to me after hearing all the different sides that I've been struggling with, vacillating between. And he says to me, but David, what do you want? And that was like a shock. I hadn't included that. I didn't include at all what I want. It was, well, what is right? What is wrong? What is right? What is wrong? But wait a second. But no matter what you do, if you don't want to do it, you're not going to do it anyway. So there was really a third option which you have to take in consideration, which is, well, what do you want? That doesn't mean I let go of all other ones, but realize that all of a sudden I'd locked myself and limited myself so much that I didn't realize that there was actually a third option. And so very often there's a third option. That I haven't had the openness to just see. So what happens with reason, it challenges the mind's account about reality and calls for an examination and verification of that which is deposited in mind. In other words, reason is basically accounting. You know? Well, in my books are these ideas. Well, now new ideas have come in. There's an income of ideas, which is challenging a certain outcome of ideas. And I'm not dealing with reality. I'm dealing with ideas that I have about reality and new ideas that have been suggested about reality. But I haven't said, well, wait a second. Let me just see reality. It's very hard to do that. In other words, the business of doubt, and he uses the word business, right? Is one of auditing the mind's accounts about reality rather than a concern with reality itself. I'm trying to work out my accounts about all the things I think about reality. Right? The problem is, I've thought so much about reality, I forgot reality. I got so used to the way I perceive things that I didn't even entertain the possibility that maybe just my conceptions are completely wrong. That's very hard to do. It deals with the content of perception rather than perception itself. I'm dealing with just the content, but wait a second. Let me just see. Doubt is not applied to that which we have an immediate awareness of. When you have an immediate awareness of something, you don't have a doubt. Right? You don't have a doubt. Do we not doubt that we exist? Or that we see? Nobody doubts they exist. They have an immediate experience that they exist. Then it can't explain why they exist, but they know they exist. We merely question whether we know what we see or whether that which we see is a true reflection of what exists in reality. That's what we have to do. We question whether what we see reflects reality. Thus, it's after perception has been crystallized in a conception that doubt springs up. So he's making a distinction between preception and conception. Preception is before I have a concept. Precept. I haven't formulated a concept. I just see it. That's the problem when people come into a program like this, or any other. Rather than coming in to perceive, they come in with conceptions. And now they're struggling with new conceptions which are being presented, which seems to be conflicting with the conceptions that they have already adopted. But one must come in with an attitude of preception. Right? I have no concept. I never heard of any of this. I just want to listen as if for the first time. Doubt then is an interdepartmental activity of the mind. That's what's going on when I'm doubting. It's all up here. It's all in my head. I'm not experiencing anything. It's all in my head. I had this experience. I once worked for an institution that was very fond of proving God. They felt that that was a very important way of instilling within people a belief in God. And a fellow came into the institute, and they began to present these philosophical arguments for the existence of God. And this fellow just didn't buy in. Just argued. And he was becoming extremely annoying for the guys that were trying to convince him. And they couldn't understand, quite frankly, why he can't accept this, right? And so they decided that they would ask me to deal with him. Because they knew that for some reason I had a different approach. So they said, maybe David Aaron can handle this guy. You know? So I'm walking with this guy and we're walking down the street. And I'm saying to him, Nathan, what's really the deal? I mean, what's going on? I'm not so into the proofs either. But you must admit that they seem to be a pretty tight argument. He says, no, you know, and I'm trying to deal with it a little more and just trying to say what's bothering him. Like, what's really bothering you? And he's saying, no, you know. And I said, well, come on. I mean, where do you really see the flaws in the argument? What are you really bothered by? At that point, he says, don't you understand? If there is a God, look at that tree. Look at that bird. Look at that flower. Look at that person. I can't. There's no God. And then I realized, oh my gosh, the problem with this guy is he sees God and everybody else is talking about him. And that's why he couldn't deal with it. So when I got back and people waiting to get the report that I succeed, they said, well, did you convince him? I said, you know what? I don't know what I did for him, but he convinced me. When he just pointed and says, look at that, it's just all of a sudden, it was like this face-to-face, eye-to-eye encounter with reality. How brilliant it is And the reason why he couldn't believe in God is God was a concept which was too small for who he believes in. Because he lived with a direct encounter with what everybody else is calling God and talking about God and philosophically, you know, arguing and demonstrating. They had proofs. He witnessed. And the word God was not enough. The concept God was not enough. And that was really powerful for me. Doubt is interdepartmental. When you say to a person, do you believe in God? That's the best way to get them not to believe in God. Because you know, what does this guy do or this woman do? Well, they bring up on the accounts, you know, they press the computer, they bring up on the screen God, you know, in the G section, right? Right? They've got all kinds of experiences and concepts and movies they saw and books they read and, you know, and religious people they met, and, you know. And then they go, nope, I don't believe in God. Right? Oh, so now you say, yeah, but. And then what happens is you get this person into an interdepartmental discussion in their treasury of concepts. And then you're in big trouble. Big trouble. I don't ask people if they believe in God. Right? It won't help them. It'll only damage them. Right? All I can do is try and facilitate a new way of seeing so they will see who I'm talking about. Whatever name. Well, we could figure out names later. Right? Figure out names later. This is what I mentioned before. Although Judaism has many names for God, not one of those names is the one name of God. Right? Because that would be the problem. We become familiar with names and we'd stop relating to the reality which that name was meant to only be a little doorway, a little window into. The name is a window. And then there's a connection. Do I think you're Emily? No. Do I think you're Amy? No. It's a name, it's a connection, it's the window. And then we connect. Then we connect. My wife told me something that blew me away. After we got married, my wife shared with me that the whole time that we had been dating, she never used my name. She never used my name. She even felt uncomfortable saying my name to her parents. And she never called me by my name. And I thought, well, that's so strange. Why? She says, because a name means a connection. And I didn't want to assume that connection yet. Names are a connection. And then there's energy, there's electricity that goes beyond the connection. The connection is very small. So all the names of God are little small connections into that electricity, that direct encounter. And so too with all the names that we are finding here with the Sefirot, once again, they're windows, they're lenses, they're a little peephole. An interdepartmental thing happening in your mind between concepts and concepts and concepts and concepts. Wait a second. Wait 1 second. Just look for the first time. Don't be afraid to look for the first time. I shared this with you in one of my classes in the evening, that was one of the ideas of 2001. Here people look for the first time, they don't know this movie, it's totally unfamiliar. These people find a monolith, this structure, and you know immediately, and they know immediately, and there's no doubt, this is a creation. This is a demonstration of intelligence. You just know that. And then the whole film is trying to find that intelligence. But then at the end of the film, this embryo grows on the film. And so one of the ideas that have been communicated about this film is it was really a clever joke. You see, you were able to look at that monolith like you never saw it before and you had no doubt that this is an expression of intelligence. And you weren't afraid to believe that. Why is it when you see an embryo that you have doubt whether it's creation or not? Because I'm afraid to believe it's a creation. Because if it is a creation, then that brings in all kinds of other things. And my computer of concepts starts springing all over the place. So I might become religious. I might start doing this. I might start dropping that. I might... Oy, gewalt. I don't want to see. I remember I was giving a class. And in the middle of my class, a fellow says to me, "Rabbi, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." "Are you allowed to ride a bicycle on Shabbat?" I said, "I'm sorry, I don't know how that... What does that have to do with my class?" So could you please answer the question? Totally out of left field. It has nothing at all to do with my class. Could you please answer the question? Are you allowed to ride a bicycle on Shabbat or not? So I said, "Well, I'll talk to you further later, the reasons, but I mean, okay, fine, just to get on with the class, no." And I saw him go, "Uh-huh." And then I realized he wasn't listening to the class. Because all he was dealing with is, if this guy makes sense, what is it going to mean? If this stuff sounds beautiful, what's going to happen? If I start buying into this, what am I going to have to give up? Well, you're not alive. You're not alive. Your vessels are totally broken. Can't receive. Sad. Totally can't taste a new flavor. Too afraid to taste a new flavor. Order the same meal every single time when there was something better on the menu. It's frightening, but it happens. It happens. I once gave a class to a group of students, and the whole time they were saying, "Well, what did you experience? Why did you become religious? You must have had some kind of religious experience." And I was trying to be, in those days, very intellectual and very reason-oriented. And I said, "Listen, why don't you guys just learn about your heritage? I mean, you're Jewish, shouldn't you know something about your heritage?" And they just kept arguing with me. "But you must have an experience. You must have an experience." Well, that went on, and I did another class, and it came back the same thing. "What was your experience?" And I didn't want to... I said, "Okay, I'm not coming to you like some... guy, oh, you know, come join me, praise the Lord. I mean, I'm just talking. We're Jews. Shouldn't we be educated?" Well, the next day we had another interaction. And it turned right back to that. They tried to get me to share a spiritual experience, a personal spiritual experience. So I got very annoyed. I said, "Okay, you want a spiritual experience? I'll tell you what I feel like spending Shabbat with you." Right? And having to deal with all this, and in contrast, how I feel Friday night at the Kotel. Now, quite frankly, I don't even remember what I said. It was a total right brain download, you know. It just poured out, and I myself was listening to it, and I explained, and I somehow communicated, the experience of Shabbat. And at that moment, the whole group went silent. Awkward silence. Nobody said anything. You see, what can you say? You can't argue with someone's experience. You can argue concepts. You can argue philosophy. But you wanted my experience. I told you my experience. There's nothing to say. But there's this awkwardness. And nobody knows what to do. So finally one guy pipes up and he says, "Okay. All right, I understand." Everybody got like, "Oh, good. He's going to answer him. He's going to give it to him. You know, he's going to rebuttal, right?" "You know what? There is no question in my mind," he says to me, "that you live a higher mode of living in consciousness than all of us." And everybody in the place goes, "Oh, no." They're like, "Oh, what is he saying?" And I'm feeling a little embarrassed because that's not what I wanted to do and that's not what I wanted, you know. "Yes, there's no question in my mind. You are clearly living on a higher level of consciousness." I said, "Yeah." And then he says, "But you know what? Who cares? Who cares?"
I got my life, I got my thing, I do my way. That's it. Who cares? Who cares? That was his attitude. Who cares? So I just looked at him and I said, but friend, if you had a dollar bill and someone said they could help you make it into a $1 million bill, you would say, who cares? You wouldn't be interested? The guy didn't know what to say. At that moment, the leader of the group says, oh, it's time for lunch. And these people ran away from me. They ran. They couldn't deal with it. They couldn't deal with it because it was putting reality in their face and saying, there could be another experience. And don't be afraid of being open for another experience. And don't try and hide behind some intellectual discussion, concept to concept. Doubt, then, is an interdepartmental activity of the mind. First we see, next we judge, form an opinion, and thereafter we doubt. We see, we judge, we form an opinion, we doubt. So I come in with all my opinions. And how could you have an opinion? Did you really learn? Did you know this? I mean, where is this opinion from? But people have such opinions. They already know. Right? I had one woman who applied for the program. And she wrote me a letter from Vancouver, I think. Dear Rabbi, I just broke off my engagement to my boyfriend who's not Jewish. And I don't know why. And when my boyfriend asked me, Judy, why are you doing this? I love you and you love me. And we've been living together already for 3 years. And I said to him, because you're not a Jew. And he then responded, but Judy, you hate Jews. And I responded, you're right. But I just can't do it. So, dear Rabbi, why did I do that? So I figured maybe it's time I learn about my heritage. I said, terrific. Okay. Send her back. Dear Judy, accepted. Program starts. Well, so the program starts and Judy doesn't show up. But that afternoon, she shows up at my door. And she says, I was registered for this program. My name is Judy. Oh, yeah, Judy. Hi. Yeah, well, I was registered for this program, but I decided it's not for me. I said, why is it not for you? She said, because I realized that I'm not a religious personality. I said, Judy, what is a religious personality? It's what I'm not. That's exactly it. It's what I'm not. I said, Judy, let's take a walk and let's talk a little bit. So we start talking, and I said, Judy, I remember your letter, and it was very powerful, and I felt your struggle, and I'm wondering what happened, So, yeah, I got a new boyfriend. Yeah, Baruch. Now everything's fine. I got a boyfriend named Baruch, some yid. So I got a Jewish boyfriend now. Right? So things, no. I said, but you did something pretty dramatic. I mean, you were living with this guy, and you say you love this guy and you broke it up because you're Jewish. Why did you do that? And I saw her eyes welling up with tears. And I said, well, what is really going on, Judy? And she said, Rabbi, don't you understand? I have a Zaidi who was a rabbi in Poland. And that's why I couldn't marry a non-Jew. So I said, well, Judy, that's really powerful. I mean, did you live with your Zaidi? No, I didn't even know him. He died before I was born. I said, well, Judy, this is very remarkable. I mean, you made such serious decisions. Her eyes are welling up more and more. She said, Rabbi, you don't understand. My Zaidi died in the Holocaust. I said, well, that's really powerful, Judy, Some of my ancestors also died in the Holocaust. My own family, I said, Judy, what's really bothering you? Do you think that your grandfather died for something stupid? And she said, Rabbi, that's exactly what I don't want you to confirm. And that was the problem. She was sure that Judaism is stupid. And I said, wait a second. You think Judaism is stupid? She said, well, come on. I mean, come on. I mean, how do you answer women's issues in Judaism? I mean, look, it's clear, it's obvious. Women are second class. I said, but have you ever had a discussion with somebody about that who's knowledgeable? I mean, come on, it's obvious. I said, why do you think it's obvious? I said, give me another thing that you think is so clearly stupid. And she gives me another thing. I said, well, how do you know that? Why do you assume that's what that means? And then what happened was, I tried to help her see that you are in a prison. Because on one hand, you've got this emotional, deep spiritual connection to being Jewish. On the other hand, you have all these concepts and you live with eternal doubt because you have all these concepts. So she decided she would do Israelite. Do you believe or don't you believe? I just want to see. I just want to be open. So, in other words, to doubt is to question that which we have accepted as possibly true a moment ago. That's what it means to be doubtful. I've already got something I've accepted. And now you're asking me to let go of something. And therefore, we're not talking and there's all this tension and I'm trying to figure out where is all this tension coming from? Because people's minds are going, my bicycle. We're talking about the sphere of Malchus. We're talking about the attribute of kingdom. This person keeps hearing bicycle in their heads. It's difficult. Doubt is an act of appeal, a proceeding by which a logical judgment is brought from the memory to the critical faculty of the mind for re-examination. That's what doubt is. You know, I draw it up on the screen, my memory screen, I put it through the critical faculty factory, and that's doubt. Accordingly, we must first judge and cling to a belief in our judgment before we're able to doubt. For a person to say, well, I really doubt that, they're basically saying, I have a preconceived notion. Right? I already have an opinion. I already have a judgment. And therefore, what they're basically saying is, I'm not willing to hear you. Right? I'm not willing to be open. But if we must know in order to question, if we must entertain a belief in order to cast doubt, then doubt cannot be the beginning of knowledge. So the person says, I would like to have knowledge. I'm on a spiritual search for truth. Well, then a person can't come in here with all these preconceived things and say, you know, I'm really open-minded, when in fact they have all these things all set up and all set up. So I think it's really funny when she said, I'm not a religious personality, when she was more religious than I was. In her views, because I've explored my views. I've struggled with my views. Right? And she has got these views that she is so sure of that she doesn't want anybody to confirm. Brilliant, right? And so this is really how you cast doubt. A person is sitting there and doubting and doubting and doubting because they're not listening. Because they're constantly comparing. And they're constantly afraid of what they might give up. And what? I'll give up, not give up. I just want to hear it. I just want to hear it, that's all. And so, if we must know in order to question, we must entertain a belief in order to cast doubt upon it. So even to question means I already have knowledge. So then doubt couldn't be the beginning of knowledge. So a person says, you know, I have a lot of doubts. And that's why I'm coming to learn about Judaism. It won't work. Right? I have a lot of doubts of whether I want to continue to be a Jew. I have a lot of doubts about some of the implications that Judaism would have in my life. And that's why I'm coming. Because I want to resolve these doubts. Well, the first thing to do is, wait a second. Maybe doubt started me off, but I can't start there. I have to say, I am ready to make myself into an empty vessel. To hear, to listen, to see, to taste, to experience. I'll form my opinions later. But I don't want my opinions to get in the way. I don't have time for that. My life is too valuable. Wonder goes beyond knowledge. We do not doubt that which we doubt. You got that? We do not doubt that we doubt. But we are amazed at our ability to doubt. Amazed at our ability to wonder. In other words, the first thing I start with is consciousness. I'm amazed that I'm conscious at all. Where did that come from? Where did consciousness come from? How did these two original elements that collided and exploded, how did after millions of years evolving out of a big bang produce consciousness? I have the ability to doubt. Where do I get the ability to doubt? I start before doubt. I wonder, how is it that I doubt at all? What is consciousness, pure consciousness? I'm amazed at the ability to wonder. He who is sluggish will berate doubt. He who is blind will berate wonder. A person who is blind just doesn't wonder. And they lose so much of the world. And it's so beautiful. Doubt may come to an end. Wonder lasts forever. Because you're always wondering, you're always seeing, and things are fresh and things are new. Wonder is a state of mind in which we do not look at reality through the lattice work of our memorized knowledge, in which nothing is taken for granted. We can never draw the truth out of borrowed or inherited knowledge. Inquire of your soul, what does it know? What does it take for granted? It will tell you only no thing is taken for granted. Each thing is a surprise. Being is unbelievable. And this I realized at the birth of my first daughter. Until reality and your life and your finger is unbelievable, God will not be believable. God will not be believable. So the entrance to believing is unbelievable. And when you're ready to look at each other, and when you're ready to hear the birds singing, and when you're ready to feel your heart beating, and you're struck with utter awe, speechless, and you just say, "This is unbelievable." You have encountered God. Or not God, because that's just a concept. You have encountered that which is.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.